Good evening. We got our warm one. Beautiful. For the sun lovers among us. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva addressed the assembled beings with great compassion. Birth and death are relentless, and you are right to tremble as you behold them, for all things are void of self-nature, and your alkaline diet will not save you. Your workout routine will not save you. The beetles will not come back and save you. Organic produce will not save you. Your vows will not save you. Mutual funds will not save you. Poetry will not save you. Zazen will not save you. Tree planting will not save you. Washboard abs will not save you. A clean car will not save you. Psychedelics will not save you. Your teacher will not save you. Big mind will not save you. Your family will not save you. Neither wit nor charm will save you. Rare gold coins will not save you. Jesus will definitely not save you. Virtue will not save you. Solar panels will not save you. Fame and fortune will not save you. Your super comfortable, sharper image, styrofoam pellet, Zafu, will not save you. Fame and fortune will not save you. Not even your mate's love will save you. Hearing aids will not save you. Expatriation won't save you. Degrees and credentials will not save you. Hope will not save you. Extended orgasms will not save you. The great mother's arms will not save you. No amount of vitamins and supplements will save you. Art will not save you. Meditations on grasping and clinging will not save you. Giddy episodes of gratitude will not save you. Antioxidants will not save you. Your grandchildren will not save you. Your reputation will not save you. The people's eventual uprising will not save you. Extraterrestrial entities will not save you, no matter how high their vibrational level. Beauty will not save you. Modesty will not save you. Invisibility will not save you. Hilarity will not save you. Clever turns of phrase will not save you. The esteem of your colleagues will not save you. Being debt-free will not save you. Hope for one more sunrise will not save you. Many of the assembled beings on that day, hearing these words and taking them to heart, immediately attained unsurpassed perfect life as it is, trembling and all. So this is a poem by Barton Stone, and I think apropos of this evening's talk. So tonight I want to talk about pain and living with pain. And I'm going to primarily tonight focus on physical pain, chronic physical pain, but I want to mention that in no way is intended to take away from emotional pain and its debilitating effects as well. It's just I had to narrow the field a little bit, so I chose, and I've addressed emotional pain quite a lot, so I thought tonight I would focus on physical pain. So I want to start by talking about a little bit about, I'm new to this iPad, so it keeps trying to pick up wireless networks in the neighborhood. Apparently there are many of them. You know, I realized preparing this that almost everything that I value, that I have learned in my life, I have learned in a difficult mind or body state. It is by coming up against those or by maybe learning to integrate those that I have learned, the deepest learnings that I've had. And really, in Zen, this is a very venerable teacher, a very venerable and honored, time-honored method of learning. In Zen, you know, we don't practice to feel good, in case any of you were wondering about that. And in particular, to feel good about ourselves or to change ourselves or to fix something. or to improve ourselves. I was up at the Russian River Zendo this weekend, and a woman said to me, "I'm just tired of seeing myself as a perpetual improvement project." And in Zen, that's not our point of view. We practice to find a source of energy and wisdom that's beyond that, that is beyond the self. We really prefer that the self sort of entertains itself, so that we can find a home in something vaster, something bigger than ourselves or what we see as the self, which is not so immediate. It's in the past and in the future. This self spends most of its time there. And so we can miss our lives if what we do is just spend our lives responding to that self. So really, the what we want the self to do is to be strong, to be loved, to be held, so much so that it can go sort of entertain itself. I mean, that's a bit, sort of do its own thing. And then we can learn from our more immediate experience. We can drop some preference that gets in the way of seeing our immediate experience. My physical pain came from a fall. Primarily came from a fall. I had some pain before that, but primarily I fell in 1993 from about 5 feet. I fell off the top of a van and landed on my back, flat on my back. And I just want to say that I remember distinctly the thought in my mind as I crashed down, as I was falling, which for a moment there, I guess you could say flying, but I was falling. And I remember thinking to myself in that instant, just instant of this occurring, it's okay. Just let yourself fall. And, you'll fix it later. I was 34 or something. I thought I could fix everything. So it'll be okay. Just let yourself fall. So I had this whole thought process about how I was going to receive the fall and what I was going to do in falling. Then I hit, which is, by the way, the painful part. The hitting. It's not the falling that's problematic. It's the hitting. So I hit, and it was excruciating. I almost passed out. I mean, tears came into my eyes just from the impact and the pain. And, I was wrong about that. I was wrong about just let it happen and I can fix it later. I could never fix it. I went doctor after doctor, neurosurgeons, orthopedic surgeons, physical therapy. I mean, I could, the litany is huge of what I tried to do to get out of pain. Vicodin early on, hated it, just put me to sleep. This is boring. I tried everything. I'm open to anything. I'm not a purist. I'm open to anything that helps with pain. To this very day, I'm still open. And the more pain I have, the more open I become about that. But I was wrong that it would just be able to be fixed. And it became a chronic problem. In about a year, I lost everything that was important, that was most important to me. I lost my ability to sit upright. I lost my ability to bow. I was at that time much thinner. I was very active. I was quite athletic. I lost that. I rode a motorcycle at that time, which I loved. I sold that. I drove a van that I camped a lot in. It was a manual transmission. It required a lot of effort to drive. I loved that van. That's the van I fell off of. I sold the van. But I also lost my sense of self. I lay on my back for 9 months because that's what I was told to do. Lay on your back for 9 months and it'll get better. And of course, come to physical therapy and blah, blah. So I did all that and gained a lot of weight. I lost my physical capacity. I lost balance because this back injury was so significant. I found out later postoperatively, I found out that entire time there was a fragment of the disc sitting on the nerve root, on the sciatic nerve root. So I lost the function of my sciatic nerve for a period of time. For 2 months after my surgery, my leg was completely numb And I thought I had lost my leg, feeling in my leg, for several months. That did return. Torturously, it returned. To just find that this leg was just a throbbing pain appendage. And it just sat there in pain all the time. I was like, can we cut it off? How bad do I really need this thing? Was my sense of it. I had lost everything. I didn't know who I was. How would I make a living? Could I still practice? What would my life be? Could I bend over to pick up my dog? Could I have a small dog anymore? Suddenly everything was up for grabs. I mean, after surgery, I couldn't use the toilet by myself. I couldn't, so life changed. And undeniably, there was no question. I mean, the surgery was like hope, and then just horror, because nothing improved. It took a year and a half for me to get it out of enough pain after surgery to even sit upright. I basically was lying down all the time, almost all the time. And then, that pain leads to other pain in knees and blah, blah. So it becomes a real cycle of working with pain. So I lost a lot of stamina, a lot of physical strength during that time. I wasn't able to exercise. I wasn't able to walk. After surgery, I walked too much, injured my back, had to start over. It's just, it's relearning. What is this thing that seems to be with me everywhere I go or seems to be carrying my body? I certainly lost hope that I could work through anything in my life. I believed that then. I lost that hope. And I understood that that was just not the truth, that damage could be done to me that could not be repaired and that perhaps could even just deteriorate. I developed what everyone I know who has chronic pain encounters. Grief at what I had lost, at what I would never have, a tremendous amount of uncertainty about the future, terror, just bald-faced fear. Can I support myself in this world? Can I make a living? Can I just live a life? Everything is up for grabs at that moment when you realize, or that period of time when you just come face to face, that your body is not the body that it was a day ago before you fell. I also went to the emergency room the evening I fell, and I was told by the doctors that I was just showing too much pain, that I looked like I was in too much pain for my injuries. That's because they didn't diagnose my injuries. They didn't know my injuries. They just saw what they saw, and they didn't do an MRI. They didn't do things that could have diagnosed the injury, the fragment. They just did x-rays and things that don't show those things. So they said it was my fault, that I was just looking too bad for the injury. So that's the kind of thing that happens socially for people in pain, especially if you look like a pretty you look like a pretty healthy person. People are like, well, why can't you sit on the floor? Can't you do everything we do? Why can't you? And then there's the people who say, hey, take this herb, walk like this, walk backwards while moving your left ear. That worked for me. Everybody has ideas about what works, for people with pain or disease or suffering. And that's all, kind. They're kind offerings. But when you're in it, it becomes irritating. It's like, you're not. It doesn't look from the outside like it looks from the inside. That's a fact about pain, and so therefore, people don't remember that you have pain. They don't. They want to walk and walk and walk. And you said at the beginning, I can't walk very far. But they're into walking and they forget that you're back there. So then, are you constantly going to assert that you have pain? You have to say it again and again. Oh no, this is too far. No, this is too much. So you're just constantly a cripple. I'm a cripple. Remember me? Oh, back here. Oh, don't forget. Oh yeah, me too. Because you said it at the beginning, but they're not in your body. So as the thing goes on, we found that with instituting alternative postures here, that it's very difficult for people who don't have physical disability or pain to remember that other people do. And I really get that, because I don't think I ever even thought about it before I had it. People used to complain about their back. I would think, oh, come on, how bad could it be? I have back pain. Right. Until I got what that really was. So I understand it from all those angles. But I certainly became isolated in my pain. And probably the most common thing I hear from people in pain, and I do a lot of work with people in pain because it feeds me. It helps me with my pain. The best antidote to my pain is being with other people in pain and helping them see the emptiness of their experience. and sometimes I can't see it for myself, but I can show them. And when they see it, I go, oh, that's so great. So I get so much from them. They teach me, and that feeds me. And so I do lots of groups for people in pain. I'm just always, hey, you have pain? Let's hang out. So it's just very renewing. So the most common thing I hear from people with chronic pain is, I need to accept my pain. I'm resisting it, and that's why it hurts. And I really think that is a gross misunderstanding of acceptance. It's a skewed idea of what accepting pain is, because it sounds passive. It sounds like I just accept it, and then that's the way it is, and so then I just have to go with it, and whatever it decides my limitations are, that's how I'm going to be limited. And, you know, and I know people who live from this place. They live entirely from the face of their pain, from the voice of their pain. And they feel victimized by their pain, almost attacked by their pain. And it is something that happens early on. I mean, you kind of go through that. If you're lucky, you get through that. And because of practice, really, I have to just say, because of practice, I could hold it differently over time. But I started there too, that this, you know, body as enemy. But actually, accepting one's pain is anything but passive. Accepting one's pain is actually an extremely active process. It requires tremendous courage. It requires to get up in the morning, you know. You wake up in pain. So now, do I put my feet on the floor? Because that's going to make more. Do I, you know... I mean, there's this moment every morning where you remake the decision. Yes, I'm going to put my feet on the floor because this pain is not me. It's not my life, actually. It's happening. It's real. I'm experiencing it. But in fact, my relationship with it is that it doesn't decide whether I get up in the morning. I decide whether I get up in the morning. And I know that I will feel pain. And I say, okay, that's the sales tax on getting up. I'll pay the tax because it's important to me to get up. It's really nothing magical. It's pretty linear decision making. But in order to accept pain, you have to maintain an energy that is not easy to maintain when you have pain, because pain takes energy. So in addition to the pain, you also have to gin up enough energy to actually be with the pain, not turn away from it, but also not be driven by it, not have it be your life and define who you are. You have to cultivate certain skills, and that's what I want to talk mostly about, the skills needed for work, for living a life, for creating a life worth living, when you will have pain every single day, no matter what you do, and you know that. And I think one of the most important skills is seeing that, which is not easy to see. I work with a lot of people in pain who are still out there, running, chasing, you know. Something's got to help me. Some doctor has the answer. I just haven't found him or her yet. Okay, it's not that specialty. I mean, I work with a lot of people who are in that place, and it's an extremely painful place. There's a lot of suffering in that place. But it's something that people have, that we do. And we should always do it, by the way. If you have pain, I think that's a track you constantly work. What can help me? What can reduce my pain? I mean, I've said in here laughingly, I have a veritable museum of sitting apparatus at my house. I mean, you ever want to sit? Come to my house. I have everything. You want to stand, lie down, sit, lean? I got it all. I have a tool to help you in every way with sitting. And they work for a while, and then they are painful. So they go on the wall, and a new one comes in. That's going to be the answer, and it will not save me. So what I have learned is there's none of those chairs, none of those cushions, none of those nothing will save me. And we have a very strong desire to be saved, actually. And it's a longing, human longing, I think. Would you just fix it for me? And so I think a part of working effectively and really becoming skillful with chronic pain is understanding that nothing will save you. and that it's just for you to arise and meet that as best you can with everything you've got. All the time. And if it's medication, and if it's a doctor with an answer, and if it's a teacher who comforts you, and if it's rocking in your bed, whatever it is, that's what it is. And you meet it with that. And I have done all of those things and other things. I have watched Korean television, you know. I mean, I have done it all to try to distract this mind. And you know, it all works for a while. But the skills we need, once you develop these skills, actually, the accepting pain is much less like accepting pain and much more like just embracing everything. Embracing everything. Because the pain is just one thing. And what one of the most important skills is to be able to, and I think Zazen is the training ground for this. I know no other training for this except Zazen. I know no other meditation training that works, that teaches this as precisely as Zazen, and that is the ability to include everything in the moment. Everything that's happening. In other words, to expand consciousness rather than focusing it in concentration practices, which is also an important skill for pain. We need to be able to concentrate on an object. That way we can move our mind around consciously. In other words, I decide where my mind is. So if my left leg is screaming, maybe it doesn't hurt right here, and I can put my consciousness right here. I can put it right here and just be right here because I know how to concentrate. That's a skill that we develop in meditation practices. But Zazen specifically has us return to no particular object of focus. That's fantastic training for people with chronic pain. Because what you learn is, let me say this, if you have chronic pain and you get up every day and you only have one thing to put your mind on, and that is your pain, that will not ever be a life worth living. I don't care how holy you are, that is not a life worth living. You cannot fabricate a life worth living out of that. If you can pay attention to 10 things in the moment, look a little better, right? Your pain and 9 other things. But if you can notice 100 things in the moment, because they're there, there's more than 100 in the moment, if you can notice the 100, your pain is 1 and 99 others, now you have a rich, nuanced life. A life worth living, a life that makes you want to get up every morning with your pain because you know it's one of 99 things that you have the capacity to receive in that moment. So the self-receiving its function. And I think people with pain learning to open to that when really what we want to do is this. We want to hunker down. You know, I often say if I could fit under my bed, you know, I would go under there because that's this feeling. You just want to, you know, like protect and guard, and you know, and the body actually does that. The body guards itself against pain. You know this. If you've ever had neck pain, all of a sudden you have shoulder pain because your shoulder's holding your neck, and you're, you know, then you have back pain because you're, you know this. Your body does this by itself. This is how the body works, one of the ways the body works with pain. So it actually makes more pain, and that's one of the problems. That response isn't necessarily great. But once you sort of gain this skill or this, I don't want to use the word gain, but you know, you understand that you have the capacity to include in that way. Then the next task is to just totally acknowledge your pain and the cost of your pain. So to really know what your pain costs you. So this is entering now, although you're working with physical pain, this is entering now the emotional realm of grief, what I could have been, what I might have had. I had to give up camping. I had to give up, you know, all the things I've had to give up that I love, that nurtured me. I was just at breakfast with someone in this room this morning, and I said, I can't walk anymore because now I've developed terrible osteoarthritis in my feet. It's very painful for me to walk, painful to be barefoot and so forth. And I have to, this person I used to walk a lot, used to take long walks, full day walks, half day walks. And it fed me, nurtured me. And I said this morning, I have to give that up. I can't do that anymore because I can't walk. And this person, being a member of my Sangha, said, no way, we're not taking that. We're going to figure it out. And that is right. That's the right response. That's an empowered response. Is okay, so you can't do that? Well, let's figure it out. Let's do it this way. Let's do it that way. Let's go somewhere we can drive right up to the spot and we'll roll you in, you know. We'll get you out there. And that's a beautiful thing that other people can do. Because I think even as long as I've worked with pain, and even as I am a practitioner and so forth, I get narrow in my views. I start to think that it's just about loss. Because that's how it feels. So it's hard to just not go there sometimes. And this morning I was sad from some other things, and that was what was there. So I said it. And that's a really why relationships are the best antidote to pain. The best antidote. Because if you can be intimate, if you can reveal your heart, tell the truth about your experience, which most of us don't, by the way. Most of us hide our pain. We hide our pain because we think we got to be looking good out there. We got to look good for other people. We got to be strong. We got to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. Got to be independent. Got to be good Americans. Got to be there for everybody, right? This is what we tell ourselves. So if we have pain, we hide it. We try not to show it. Certainly emotional pain. Never show emotional pain. It's bad. Especially if you're male in this culture. So we hide our pain. And what that does is it isolates us even more. And when it's the last thing we need is to be isolated. But showing your pain requires a vulnerability. It requires a willingness to say, I'm weak. I can't walk anymore. I'm weak. I can't do this or that. And weak is like the worst case scenario to me. Acknowledging weakness. Bad. I've worked my whole life to survive by being strong. I can do anything, right? I can fix it. Just fall. You can fix it. Yeah. That philosophy, that's where that got me. So pain requires a whole different skill set about asking for help, about being vulnerable, about being willing to show up in pain and be received, however you're received. Sometimes that's a beautiful response I got this morning, but sometimes it's like, oh, you know, and sometimes it's just like, oh, well, we're going for a walk anyway. See ya, you know, whatever it is. People, not everybody knows how to include people with pain. And I love it that our Sangha does that. Actively and consciously includes people who can't sit like Buddha for hours on end. That's beautiful. Because, you know, all our bodies are changing. And those of you who have not had pain, you will. And you may need to lie down for a period of zazen now and then. And I want Santa Cruz Zen Center to be a place where you feel free to do that. Because look at you. Here you are, looking like Buddhas. You should be able to lie down if you need to do that. And by the way, let me just mention, there is pain in every posture. Pain in every posture. When I first learned about lying down, I wept. I thought, oh, no, okay, I won't have pain. Not. Just different pain. Now my arms fell asleep. Now I had arm pain. Then I developed a neck problem now. Neck pain. Arm pain. So that came from lying down posture. I mean, I learned it from lying down posture that I had that. So there's pain in every position, so if you think, oh, I'll lie down and I won't have pain, that's not true. But so I don't want to make false promises about alternative postures. But it does help a great deal for certain kinds of pain, and I think we should have it available. But it's not a panacea. It's not a savior. It won't save you. Lying down will not save you. People ask me often, what should I do when my pain gets so severe that I can't function? Like if I'm in the middle of sesshin and I cannot do it. I'm just in too much pain. What should I do? And I think this is a very, very deep question. And usually when people ask it, they're very vulnerable. They've realized that this pain is not going anywhere. And it's going to be there. It's going to be there for a long time. And they're wanting to know, what should I do? And they often ask me, what do you do? And when they ask me what they should do, the advice I give is turn toward your suffering. Turn toward your suffering. And I want to comment on this first by saying, turning toward is not a single action. It's not a 180-degree activity. Okay? It's actually a 360-degree activity. So I don't think that, you know, you turn toward and you never look away and you just have to suffer through it and you should just sit through it no matter what and sweat. And I mean, I did this for years. I don't think it's what people should do. And I think that's different from turning toward your pain. So I think we turn toward our pain and then we look away. Then we look again, look away. Till pretty soon we can look a little longer. Maybe look around a little bit. Maybe a little bit more. That's all turning toward. All of that is the process of turning toward. Because turning toward our pain is not so easy. It's hard to look at ourselves. How many people, you know, really do zazen every day for years on end? It's hard to look at that every day, day in and day out, and stick with it. So why do that? It seems to me that most of us, people who sit, you folks here, you have a certain stability that you've gained through your practice. You have the capacity to enter pain. And so if you should find yourself in a period of great pain in your lives, you already have skills to work with that pain. You have the ability to settle into suffering. This is our practice. This is what Zen, you know, the Buddha said is First Noble Truth. There is suffering. And of course, he talked about paths out of suffering. But that's all there. But I think on a day-to-day basis in our lives, you know, in our walking around marketplace lives, the ability to notice the excruciating details of our pain, to stay with it, to stay embodied, to really spend a lot less time running away. And this is what Zazen, this is what we learn in meditation, right? The vow, by the way, in meditation, as you know, is not to stay. The vow is to return. Okay? So naturally, the mind wanders. And pain will hijack the body, hijack the mind, take you into it. And so this stability to remain upright, to remain in posture, to encounter all the suffering that we encounter, to have our hearts broken 1,000 times a minute is what my teacher used to say. We develop in Zazen the stability to have our hearts broken 1,000 times a day. I think she used to say 1,000 times an hour. I think she had a harder life than I do. But the point is this stability. And this is another essential skill in Zazen, and that we practice in Zazen, and is so important when living lives with pain. But I also do think a lot of people have wrong ideas about how meditation helps with pain. And so they start a meditation practice, then they beat themselves up because they're not feeling better. My pain's still here. My pain's still here. It gets worse when I sit, you know. And they don't know. They don't understand. And they also say, how can you be so, you know, so reactive when you sit, you're a Zen person, you know, aren't you Zen? Zen, or, you know, whatever Zen is to them. And pain challenges some of that. All our pain, all our conditioning, you know, conditioning is pain by nature. So we all have this, whether we're thinking of it as physical pain or not. Conditioned mind is pain by nature. So we all have it. And it's chronic. For all of us. So, but here's the thing. People think that meditation will take their difficulties away. And that's not the purpose of meditation with pain. They think painful emotions will go away. It's a very common misunderstanding I encounter with early meditators. But you know what? Even a Buddhist experiences old age, sickness, and death. Even a Buddhist experiences pain. Even a Buddha experiences old age, sickness, and death, loss of things that matter. So here's how I think meditation helps with pain. I think because suffering isn't what it looks like from the outside, we often tend to project a future. And this future always contains all our limitations, but rarely do we bring forward our resources. And when you have pain, you have to consciously bring forward your resources constantly. You enter a room, you look around. What comforts me here? And you can find something in every room that comforts you, actually. If your consciousness is refined and you can see something in everything, in every moment, the 100 things, you look for the other 99 everywhere you go. You look for who's around you. That when I was ordained, I was worried because there are many, many bows in the ordination ceremony. and I had practiced. I had even hired someone to help me learn how to mark physical movement. You know what I mean? I didn't know that word. She taught me that word. But in other words, not to throw yourself into every one because you know you have 50 of them, but to do about 30 of them in this way of marking and then do 20, you know. So literally, I mean, I paid a consultant to help me figure out how to manage that many bows. But I was still worried that I wouldn't be able to do it. So Dana, who was ordained with me, who can bow without touching the floor and looks perfect in the Zendo and never makes a sound and, you know, is perfect, I said to her, you know, please don't bow too fast because I'll still be, you know, on the floor and you'll be ready. And so she said, fine. She slowed down to accommodate. And she also, I said, please, if I'm just stuck there, if I'm just kneeling there and I should be standing, just put your hand down and help me up. And because I was scared I would get stuck and not be able to get up. And so I looked around at my resources, and one of them was my Sangha mate, who was going to be right beside me through the whole thing. And so I just simply asked her specifically for some kinds of help. I also looked at the setup of the room very carefully. This is why I'm into rehearsing ceremonies. But I looked at the setup of the room, and I knew there would be a short table in front of me. So I asked permission of Catherine to put my hand on the table when standing. And that helped me be able to hold everything I was handed and without dropping. You know, it gave me a little more stability. Trying to get up with no hands from a kneeling position is difficult. So that's what I do every day, all day. Every day, all day, everywhere I go, restaurant, someone's home, go somewhere for a meeting. Everywhere I go, this is what I'm doing all day. I'm in the minutiae of my pain and my resources and the task at hand and what will it take to meet all those things without falling, you know, hopefully with a little grace. Let's just put it that way. Hopefully with a tiny bit of grace. So people ask me, do you practice bowing? Yes, I practice bowing. I practiced bowing for a long time. I have to re-practice bowing because my body changes and my pain changes. I'm having two vertebrae in my neck fused probably in October. The first thing I said to the surgeon, will I be able to bow? What do you mean? Here's what it looks like. Will I be able to do this afterward? And I made him show me that my neck would be able to do that motion, or I wasn't going to do the surgery. Because bowing is so important to me that that's a stick in the river for me. So I really, now there will come a day when I won't be able to do it, and I know that. And I'll have to give it up then, and I'll have to go through my grief and all the things again. So I want to just send the message, it's not a one-shot deal. It's not like you deal with it one day and then the next day you're free of it. Or you don't have to use these skills every day. You use them every single day and rely heavily on your Sangha and people around you to show up with able bodies and help you meet your life. So through acknowledging your pain, you sort of move off the hungry ghost track with your pain. You stop feeding it. You stop feeling like it's just starving and you have to feed it all the time. And that frees up some energy so that you can then get creative and start to look more creatively at what's around you and what resources are available and what you bring, actually, the strength you do bring, even if you're in pain or you're feeling weak. Or you're off balance, which is the main way that I feel weak. So if you never acknowledge the pain and you just try to run from it, it just chases you. It's always there. Your body is recording your running and feeling it, you know, that energy of avoidance. And you're paying for that, whether you think so or not. And eventually it catches up. I don't know anybody with whom chronic pain is not eventually caught up. I think that... you know, meditation training helps us forego our preferences. It helps us understand that we can let go of a preference and be okay, that it won't kill us if we sit through a sitting period with pain or discomfort. Or it won't kill. It took me years to lie down in the Zendo, not because no one said I could, but because who wants to lie down when everybody around you is sitting up like a perfect Buddha? So I'm going to barrel in and lie down and take two spaces? And I mean... So there, that was ego. That was an ego response. I had to let go of that. I had to drop that in order to lie down. And therefore, and I did it, I really did it because I wanted other people to feel like they could do it. here. So I lie down sometimes, not because I need to lie down for one sitting period, but because I want to send the message that it's okay to lie down. And so I feel like that's something I can offer. So meditation teaches us about preference and how we're in charge of that, actually, and we can decide about preferences. Suffering calls forth deep resources. And resources that are already in us. And I love the 500 Lives as a Fox koan for this teaching. You know, there may be hundreds and thousands of regrets in a lifetime. It could be that there are hundreds and thousands of regrets. But if I have found within myself the capacity to live life as a fox, 500 lives as a fox, with some modicum of grace and hundreds of thousands of regrets, then that's pretty good. And I think meditation helps us understand that and have a different relationship with that, with all of that difficulty. You learn in meditation, especially if you do long sittings, sesshins, you learn to take pleasure from the mundane. You learn that it is actually in the mundane that pleasure lies. That pleasure is not something, you know, people say to me all the time, well, I can't go to a movie. I can't sit through a movie. Got it. So the movie is the only thing he can think of as something to where he can get pleasure. Wow. Such suffering in that. Because he can't do the movie. So pleasure is not something outside us that we have to go seek. The teaching here is that pleasure is endemic in every moment. Just as pain and suffering are endemic in every moment, so is pleasure. So again, if we have a consciousness refined enough to see the hundred things, many of those things will actually comfort us and be pleasurable. And if we can work with that alongside the pain without turning away from the pain, but also allowing in all that the moment is full of, I think that's one way that meditation helps, because it shows us how we can do that. It's not a thing we come naturally to, I think, to receive comfort from mundane objects. I want to point out my hankies. I get so much comfort from my hankies. And I didn't have hankies until my teacher died, and now I have like 20 of them. I love them. I have them everywhere. Every pocket I own has one in it. And I actually realized one day, shortly after she died, I was rating my days. I still rate my days by the number of hankies, so today's been a 3-hanky day, 3.5. But I realized one day when I was laundering them how comforting they are to me. How they're just like little blankets to me now. They've become a comfort. And so now I have a whole ritual with them, because I like want to give them something back. So I have this whole washing thing, and I fold them a certain way, and I hang them to dry, and then I fold them really flat so they fit in pockets. And I smell them all the way into my, because I wash them with bleach, which I love the smell of bleach. So I have a smell that I love and a feel that I love, and they're just so accessible. They're so accessible, so easy. And so that's an example, just a mundane object, you know, that has just come to comfort me. It comes forth, and it offers itself to me, and I receive it. That's all I have to do, is just receive it. It's an amazing thing. Objects do this all the time. Darlene used to talk about her microwave coming forth and comforting her. So, and I never understood it. It's like, okay, I get it now. Yes. Your microwave. When you're laying in bed and you all you can manage to do is get your feet into the kitchen and get a frozen dish and put it in the microwave to have food, you bow to your microwave. You know, your microwave comes forth and comforts you. It feeds you. It nourishes you. It makes your life possible, actually, under those conditions. So it's amazing what a life of pain shows you about the physical world, actually. So I could go on about what meditation does and doesn't do, but I think the main, most important thing is that it allows us to refine consciousness so that we can receive more, and it allows us to learn to be stable and let go of preferences one moment at a time. Does that mean I can always do that, that I'm always magnanimous with my pain? Heck no. Sometimes I'm just mad. And when I'm mad, I do all kinds of things. I have a wiffle bat. I go outside with my wiffle bat and bat wiffle balls all over the place. I have about 30 wiffle balls. I whack them around. I let myself be mad. I want to move the energy out of my body. When you have pain, you do not want energy stuck in your body because it will add to your pain. Guarantee it. I mean, it's true of me. It's like a linear thing. So if I'm angry, if I'm excited, I will seek a way to move that energy. I have gone to this thrift store over here and bought plates and gone home and hooked my tarp to my fence and thrown glass plates against my fence. It's fabulous. Loud and scary and weird. And my dog's running in the house and I'm out there wham, wham. And it just releases energy. If the body is not really a container. It's more like a hollow bone. It's meant to move things through. And pain doesn't. It changes and moves, but it doesn't leave if it's chronic. So I can't afford to let other energies settle here. I have enough on my plate, so to speak. So although I have done a lot of healing, I am still in the process of healing. My situation really leaves little room for hope. I will have pain my entire life. It will get worse. It will not improve. Hopefully, I'll get out of a little pain, arm pain, with this neck surgery, but it will, guess what? It will have pain, other pain. And I know that. Spinal problems are kind of like that, and nerve pain in particular is like that. But I have many, many resources. I have a Sangha. I have a practice. I have many more and more moments every day. The ability to say, "Oh, look at the 100,000 greens in that one tree." Just to be amazed by the mundane, by the ordinary, by the pothole. Like, you know, I can be sitting at a red light and study a pothole and take joy in it. I can find it there. And I love that I have that capacity because I know that as I age, I'm going to become more, more impaired. We all will. If we're lucky enough to age, you know, we will lose capacity and so forth. And I can find it anywhere. I can find it on the ceiling of a white room. I know that because I have sat under the ceiling of a white room and found it. So it's just there. I'm using the word found loosely. It's just there. And it's a matter of seeing it, meeting it. It's not a matter of searching it out. It's just there. And knowing that it's there when you're in screaming pain is the training of Zazen, the returning. And so resources, resources, resources. There are many strategies I could talk about. I have a lot of strategies here. I think the best strategy for pain is caring for other beings, whoever and however big or small they are, whatever they are, another being. You can have a plant, that's what you can take care of. Give that plant your care. That is an antidote to pain. And the second thing is doing things just for the sake of doing them. It's very nourishing, deeply nourishing to the body to just do things without any idea of an outcome or anything coming from it. I'm just doing it to do it. I'm walking to walk. I'm sitting to sit. It's very nourishing to us to do that. So that's that's a very important strategy as well. What time is it? Time to end? I saw you look forward, Patrick, and I'm okay. So I just want to say I'll close with this piece, which is why. In anyone's right mind, would they turn toward this kind of tragedy? Why would we? Why would someone make a conscious choice to turn toward this kind of pain? And I think there are basically three strategies that one can use with pain. One is distraction. You can work and work and work, and I've done all of them, by the way, distraction. The other is just constantly working to find more and more and more and more comfort in samsara. Okay, just, you know, can I find the better chair, the different position, the food, the whatever, fill in the blank, samsara, all this birth, you know, breath and death. And to try to just find more and more comfort in that, or, you know, have more money, have a bigger house, have whatever, you think it is that it is going to provide that comfort. I think that in order to make an intelligent decision about whether to use distraction, and denial also is good, and these are good strategies. I'm not saying they're bad strategies. They're all good. They're temporary. That's the problem with them. But they're very good for a while. And I use them all on a regular basis. I mean, I think those are some of my resources. Denial, distraction, and comfort in samsara. But I also know that they're limited. And so in order to make an intelligent decision about whether to use those strategies, one should know the price of those strategies. And the main price of those strategies is that in running from pain, we are also running from pleasure. We are also running from joy. We are also distracting ourselves from what deeply nourishes us. And so essentially we end up starving. We end up, a thirsty fish. Because we're so far out there and we've lost ourselves in the process. In trying to avoid pain, we've lost ourselves. And so I think that's the biggest price of that decision. So it's a fair decision, and I totally understand it. People make it. I'm like, right on. You know, you go. You think you can do it? Let me know. You know, let me know in 5 years. I'd love to hear if you could do it. And I seriously mean that. I mean, if somebody can really succeed in that, that's great. But I could not succeed in that. And I paid a very high price for trying. So I just think it's good to know what the sales tax is before you buy the item. So, thank you for listening to me talk about my pain. And I'm wondering if any of you have questions. We have 5 minutes for questions or so. Or thoughts or anything at all. Well, that's what I'm talking about tonight. I've also talked about emotional pain. Yeah.
I'm wondering if they're not the same at some level.
But,
the emotional pain, physical pain, blow our mind out of the water, we lose presence, and we have to come back.
Yes. I think this is a great question, and it is a question I ask because I have both. I had emotional pain long before I had physical pain, so I've worked my entire life with emotional pain. But I do think the one most significant difference I can name between working skillfully with emotional pain and working skillfully with physical pain is that with emotional pain, in my experience, I have to give it place. Right? So I have to not only name it, but I have to say, where is it in my body? And once I can identify where it is in my body, then I can apply the same sorts of principles to it. So I work with a lot of anxiety and panic. So I finally learned, it took me years to place it in my body. And now I don't any longer really experience the emotion. I experience the physical sensation. I say, oh, there you are. All right, anxiety and panic, you're back. And then I settle in that physical sensation. I settle in that, and I say, okay. And I essentially do zazen in that sensation, and that's what I was taught. And so I use that to this very day. But I have to give it a physical place in order to really apply these principles. For me, that's what helps. And that's the only difference I've been able to find so far. Thank you. I think, did someone else? Yes.
Emotional pain, even if they have emotional pain, it can make the person more compassionate.
I do think that's right. I think it's about acknowledging one's own pain. I think once you fully acknowledge your own pain and you take it in, like all that it means to your life, yes, I am not as strong as I was, and I might not be as strong as he is, and I can, will never sit like the Buddha, like Chuck does, or, you know, and so on. Once you really own that, then a lot of illusion drops off, and you look at other people and you see their suffering. You just see it. You see it because yours is out front now. And so they see yours, you see theirs, and you meet there. I cannot tell you how this has changed my life, that I just simply see it in others' eyes. And they meet my eyes, and we see each other there. And it can be, I don't know what their pain is. I've never met them, maybe. But we can see each other. There's a transparency that develops from it. What is the mechanism? I think it's just this complete and total acknowledgement. And there's tremendous fear in that total acknowledgement, because the fear is, I'm just going to live tragedy for the rest of my life. And so then, you know, who wants to do that? So that's where these other kinds of skills and refining of consciousness come in. And also to know that tragedy will get its due. Because I'm afraid to let go of the tragedy too. Like it might not get enough energy if I let it go. Somebody has to give it energy. But I've discovered that it will get its due. One of the things that working with my pain brought up for me was really an understanding of the amount of silent suffering that there is in this world. That people, almost everybody, is suffering in their hearts. And we can't show it to one another. I know people with chronic disease that should be completely visible, that fight with their bodies to hide it in front of other people. Hide trembling from Parkinson's or hide, you know. Because I'm a large person, I often try to hide my pain. Because people, thin people, blame fat people for their pain, especially nerve pain, back pain. You know, well, if you just lost weight. And I had a doctor tell me this a week ago. She never asked me, was I injured? She never asked me how I got to be in pain. She never asked me anything about me. What do you do about your pain? How do you work? Never, not ask me one question. Fat woman, pain, lose weight. Done. So those kinds of social stigmas. And so I think, but I became very acutely aware of this silent suffering that is everywhere. And I think it's just opened up for me. Because I realized that how much I try to hide my pain. So now I lie down when I maybe could sit up, because I want to show that it's okay. I sometimes ride a scooter at Safeway, not because I can't walk through Safeway and buy my groceries, but because I want to say, yes, I'm acknowledging that I have a body with pain, and I'm gonna live it out loud. And I'm sorry if it makes other people uncomfortable. So we can talk about that. Anybody else? Thank you, Patrick. I dedicate this talk and our time together this evening to all those suffering silently in this world, unseen and unheard, and to the fulfillment of the Buddhist practice for all beings. Beings are numberless.